including five set for oral argument. This is the third of the five cases. This is A22-0291, George Cornelius Watkins versus State of Minnesota. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal. When you approach the podium, please feel free to state your name for the record and your client's name, and let us know if you would like us to refer, how you would like us to refer to you and your client during the argument this morning. Otherwise, the normal rules of court decorum apply, and you can use either the podium next to you or the one in the middle. The one in the middle does have the timer as well as the button to raise and lower the podium. And with that, appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. My name is Amber Johnson. I represent Mr. George Watkins in this matter, the appellant. You can refer to me as Ms. Johnson and Mr. Watkins as the appellant. The appellant in this case should be granted a new trial because the district court improperly denied his post-conviction motion. First, the appellant established by preponderance of the evidence that BT's testimony at trial was false. Second, the appellant also established by preponderance of the evidence that the jury's verdict might have been different without the false testimony from BT. When there is false testimony...
Just a minute. Before we get into the facts of this case, I have a couple of questions about what you just stated, about the Larison test. I agree that the rules require, or the statute 590.04 requires a fair preponderance, so we know the standard of proof. But in terms of that first element, the way we keep saying it, it's not that it was false. We say that the court, meaning the district court, is well satisfied, reasonably well satisfied that it is false. So what is our standard of review to determine whether the district court was reasonably well satisfied with something?
I believe the standard of review would be, as to the factual issues at the case, would be clearly erroneous. As to the legal issues, it would be de novo.
As to the falsity, or to use a different word, credibility.
Correct.
What is their standard of review? Because it is, you would agree with me, at least, that it seems a bit odd that we are required to review essentially a credibility determination as part of the first factor of the Larison test. That's not normal, right?
Correct. And preponderance of the evidence and well-satisfied also are oddly put in the same analysis because they don't really seem to make the mean the same thing.
I completely agree. There is no evidence about what the court was well-set. No one called the judge to the stand and asked the judge, were you satisfied and to what degree and why, right? So the preponderance of the evidence standard would not be met if we required a preponderance of evidence regarding the court's degree of satisfaction.
I think what we would have to look at under the Larison test is the judge's order, his findings of facts, and how they match up to the record, meaning the testimony that was given at the evidentiary hearing, at trial, and the other submissions by the petitioner. And then additionally, look at how those facts, whether facts were admitted, whether facts were misinterpreted or outright misstated in the order, and see how the court analyzes whether or not they should be well satisfied that the testimony at trial was false.
Ms. Johnson, that was going to be my follow-up question. So as I read the order, I'm satisfied the judge was well satisfied. So but the point you're making is that our whole review then is, was it reasonable? Was the judge reasonably? And then that still goes back to the abuse of discretion and or, well, clear error first.
Well, whether
so
or not...
you're asking us to, in effect, if we were ruling your favor, it was unreasonable for the judge to be well satisfied based on this record.
Yes, that's what I'm arguing. I'm arguing that... let me note that in Dobbins v. State, they stated that the Layerson requirement could be satisfied by witnessed alleged statements that directly contradict their trial testimony, but not explicitly admit that they were testifying falsely.
Right, so I think there is a distinction between inconsistencies, discrepancies, and something that's false, right? So we're not called on to review whether the court was well satisfied that they're different. We're called on to review whether or not the court was well satisfied that one was false. And to me, that requires us, in a way, to make a credibility determination, or on the other hand, we're required to defer to the credibility determinations of the district court, and that first part of Larison would almost always be favoring the state, depending on what review we give, right?
I would agree. But I would note that in this order, the judge never finds that BT is not credible, never says anything about her credibility, except for using her testimony from the evidentiary hearing and the trial, which are substantively very different, to support the finding that false testimony was not presented at trial.
Ms. Johnson, though, isn't that the point, though, of the judge's order is the only times that she testified, she's sworn, and in her most recent sworn testimony, she says, my trial testimony was accurate.
She does, but then she also testifies that she was testifying truthfully at the evidentiary hearing, where she told a completely different story about basically the moment of time of when she entered that bar and when she got in the car.
But when the district, when the post-conviction court questioned her specifically about her testimony that she gave at trial, she said that it was truthful, and she did not mislead the trial in that testimony. And basically, she said that testimony is going to be more truthful than what I'm saying today because it happened so many years ago.
Two things. First, when the court said that in the order, I mentioned this in my brief, but when he asked her specifically about whether or not she was misleading the jury, he said, let me just jump in and get to the point that I think you're both touching on. Did you deliberately mislead me or the jury about whether or not your phone had died back when you testified in 2014? That question was only about the phone. The witness's, or BT's, answer was, I don't recall. And then the court said, all right, and that's at page 21.
So again, I'm having a hard time getting to the facts of this case without knowing exactly our framework. And as I look at the case law around, you say, Larison, whichever, we do have cases. Wilson v. State, quoting Opsahl to say, we caution post-conviction courts not to make a determination on the reliability of the recantation without first evaluating credibility, right? There's this discussion in Ferguson about the genuineness of the recantation. Again, getting back to credibility, although arguably credibility of the second statement, not the trial testimony. So what are we supposed to do if the Larison first prong is essentially a credibility determination? To call something false means that you have discredited it, you've decided it doesn't have credibility. So how do we review that? Do we defer, or do we step in ourselves and evaluate credibility?
I think in this particular case, I don't know if you have to evaluate credibility. And that is because the court didn't say that she wasn't credible at any point in time, that BT wasn't credible. What the court did is it determined that it's going to decide that her testimony in 2004 is more reliable because it was closer in time. And I just want to, in Caldwell v. State, it's 853 Northwest
2nd. That seems like a credibility determination to me, to be honest. To say that this one statement is more reliable than another, that is to give more credit to one statement than the other. I don't know what distinction there is there.
Well, for instance, you can simply say that that was wrong, that he erred in deciding that.
Well, if I may interrupt, because I'm going to be a little bit more direct.
Yep.
it seems to me that this is a credibility determination by the post-conviction court. And we give great deference, whether it's a post-conviction court or the district court, to credibility determinations, unless the record does not support it, or we are left with a definite and firm conviction that that credibility determination is wrong. So we give a lot of deference to credibility determinations. And Martin, I think, actually goes further in terms of the first prong of the Larson test and focuses on whether there was a recantation of prior testimony and says that the post-conviction court must reasonably ascertain whether the recantation is genuine. So the post-conviction court, when it is hearing the testimony at the post-conviction hearing, can make that credibility determination, is the recantation genuine? And if it's not, then the first prong of the Larson test is not met. Isn't that what the post-conviction court did here and said, in essence, the recantation is not genuine?
I think that the court decided that he couldn't be sure that the testimony at the trial was false. I don't know if he does go to the recantation as being genuine when he's talking about BT giving the statement to the interviewer, the investigator, Gray. But I will note, and I did in my brief, that every single thing that BT said to the investigator is exactly what she testified to at the evidentiary hearing.
But going to that, the statement to the investigator, she never said that those statements were truthful. She only said that that is what she told the investigator. She never signed the affidavit. It wasn't even her affidavit. It wasn't notarized as a statement that she is giving under oath. So there's nothing in that statement that goes to truthfulness.
I would agree with the statement that she gave the investigator, but at the same time that she denied saying that those things were true, she testified to those exact same facts at the evidentiary hearing when asked questions about what happened. So,
but her statements at the post-conviction hearing were at best contradictory, because she also said what she testified to earlier, she was being truthful. She said several times those were truthful statements that she made.
She also said that she remembered what she testified to about the vehicle at trial. Yet she was asked numerous questions about how she got in that vehicle, did not say what she said at trial.
Well, but with all due respect, I'm not sure the testimony with respect to the vehicle really matters, because the kidnapping was an ongoing occurrence, and that continued on into the home. So how she got into the vehicle, whether she did it intentionally or on her own volition or because she felt forced to, I think, quite frankly, is immaterial to the kidnapping charge.
Well, when it comes to, I think, to address the issue that we've been talking about of what is your role here, I think in
I also want you to address Judge Reyes's question about the second part of the test.
Even
if it were false about how she got in the car, it may not matter under the second prong.
Well, I will answer the second prong first, and then I'll go back to the other. The second prong is that without the false testimony, the jury might have reached a different verdict. In the district court's order at addendum page 11, he applied the wrong analysis to determine whether or not there would be impact on the jury verdict. In it, he says, the court concludes that even if BT's testimony had been presented as in the evidentiary hearing, the jury verdict would have been the same. In Dobbins v. State, the Supreme Court said in a footnote 4, under Larison, the substance of the statement to Harris is relative only to determine whether his testimony is false under the first prong of the Larison test. The substance of the recantation has no relevance to the second prong of the Larison test, whether the jury might have reached a different conclusion.
So then the remedy would be send it back to apply the correct second prong?
They say that you should consider only the impact the alleged false testimony had on the jury rather than guess what the impact would have been. And as for...
Is that then our remedy is what? If I agree with that, that the district court... It is a slight distinction, I can understand. Wouldn't the remedy be we send it back for the district court to analyze the proper number two?
I suppose that could be an option. As for the credibility aspect, in the Supreme Court in Caldwell has a discussion about the dissent's view, and it says, in the dissent's view, if a witness testified at trial, A occurred, but then later stated A did not occur, but B did, we cannot conclude that the first statement is false unless the witness adds, and by the way, I lied at trial. Fortunately, Minnesota law is not that way. For one thing, witnesses may have understandably reluctant to admit that they testified falsely under oath because of perjury. Evasive answers by witnesses do not necessarily mean that the witness did not testify falsely at trial or recant his or her testimony. Rather, evasiveness is potentially relevant to whether recantation is credible. The facts of this case that were presented at trial. Oh, thank you for your time.
I do have one follow-up. That statement that you had at the very end, the issue is whether recantation is credible. I think that kind of ties back to our earlier. Isn't that a credibility determination by the post-conviction court? And if that's the case, isn't something that we give great deference to?
Yes, you give deference to, but it is not impossible to find that a judge made an error in deciding whether or not they should have found it to be credible, or should have found that the trial testimony was false.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes.
May it please the court, Annika Johnson, certified student attorney from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, on behalf of the state of Minnesota. My supervising attorney, Adam Petras, is present with me in the courtroom. This is a case about a victim of long-term domestic abuse who has been trying for years to get the abuser, appellant, to leave her alone. The victim testified at trial in 2014 and again at the evidentiary hearing in 2021 about what happened to her, and her testimonies were fairly consistent. As such, the post-conviction court correctly denied appellant's motion for post-conviction relief because appellant failed to establish under the first prong of Larison that the victim's original testimony was false. The post-conviction court correctly granted an evidentiary hearing to parse out the merits of the claim, and there were none. The victim's testimony at the evidentiary hearing was made under oath. The victim testified...
Well, just a minute. Before we get to that part of it, I am interested in your response to kind of this dialogue we were having about the first prong. I'll ask it this way. Typically, when we look at credibility determinations, the law says we must defer to the credibility determination of the district court. Do you think that's the same as saying... it's unreviewable? It seems different than, for example, clear error, where we're looking at whether or not the evidence could support this fact-finding, or do we have a firm conviction that there was a mistake? That's kind of clear error language. Must defer sounds a lot like unreviewable. So what is the state's position as to the typical credibility determination from a district court and what our standard of review, if any, there is for that? And then I'm going to ask you to compare that to what's in the Larison number one.
Sure. So the state's position is that this court reviews that credibility determination for clear error. This court is reviewing whether or not Judge Quam clearly erred in his credibility determination between that trial testimony and the evidentiary testimony. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you.
And so to be clear, you're saying that we review the credibility determinations under the Larson test here for clear error. So the clear error standard applies, so it's not necessarily just complete deference and we don't touch it at all.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
So when the victim testified at the evidentiary hearing, she testified for the state. And she said that her statement to appellant's private investigator was, those statements were not true, and that she only talked to the investigator in hopes that it would get the appellant to leave her alone. The victim further testified that her trial testimony was not false, and she didn't mislead the jury. Judge Quam presided over both the trial and the evidentiary hearing. He is best positioned to determine the reliability of that testimony. And Judge Quam did not clearly err in finding that the testimony is truthful and therefore not granting a new trial.
Do you think there's a difference between, let's talk about standard of proof now, apart from standards of review. Standard of proof, preponderance, we know what that means, if the scale tips ever so slightly. Is that different than reasonably well satisfied? Because they seem, again, at odds. Would you agree?
Yes, but can you say that again?
Yeah, so the preponderance of the evidence standard of proof requires, if you put the evidence on a scale, it just tips ever so slightly, that's preponderance. That's what's required under the statute for post-conviction petitions. But our Larison test says reasonably well satisfied, that the district court was reasonably well satisfied. And it seems to me that might be less, or it could be more than a preponderance test. So that's my question. Is it the same? Is it different? If it's different, is it more or less than preponderance? Is it itself a separate standard of proof built into that first factor that would be different from the general standard of proof we apply for post-conviction cases?
So the preponderance of the evidence, that's the standard necessary for the post-conviction, hearing, and that is... That is a lower standard, and the district court was right to grant that evidentiary hearing to parse out the merits of the claim, and they didn't find any merits to that claim. And I don't think I have a firm answer on whether or not reasonably well satisfied is less or more than preponderance of the evidence, but the district court was correct in granting that evidentiary hearing. And that is a lower standard than granting, say, a new trial.
So I'll go back to kind of the facts of this case then and
sure.
Give you a chance to apply it now that I understand your framework. Determination under that first factor, looking at the statement at trial versus the statement in the recantation with the private investigator that's unsigned, et cetera, versus the statement at the hearing, what's your best argument as to why those... When you compare those things, the only conclusion for us to reach is that the district court doesn't make any error in saying that the petitioner failed or appellant failed to establish that necessary prong.
The only difference between those statements is this idea of physical force versus psychological force. That's what appellant is alleging makes the testimony false, and it doesn't, because that doesn't change the substance of either testimony as it pertains to the kidnapping charge at issue. And force is not an element of kidnapping. The elements of kidnapping are to remove someone from one place to another and without their consent. That doesn't include force language, and so the type of force, that doesn't matter for the charge at issue. I mean, what's clear from the testimony is that the victim was motivated by a real fear based on years of abuse and that she did not consent to getting in the vehicle. So the force doesn't matter.
That does kind of tie into the second prong in Larison.
Sure.
Why don't you address that piece for us?
Sure. So under the second prong of Larison, even if we remove this line of the testimony, if we take out the point in time where victim enters the vehicle, as Judge Reyes previously mentioned, that doesn't change the fact that we're talking about an ongoing crime. Kidnapping is an ongoing offense. It doesn't happen at one moment in time. So when it begins doesn't matter, and it doesn't mean that the jury might have reached a different outcome. If the court doesn't have any further questions, the state would respectfully request this court to affirm the post-conviction court, and the state will rest on its brief.
I have one question.
Okay.
As I asked opposing counsel, the two prongs, let's say we agree with appellant on that first prong. It seems that appellant's argument now is that we the remedy, if there's an error on the second prong, is to send it back. So why don't you address, A, whether there's an error in the application of the way that the district court analyzed that second prong, and B, do you think that we can, on this record, affirm, or are we unable to review it and have to send it back?
Sure. So under the second prong, I mean, the issue that appellant has with the district court's order is the way that they worded the second prong. But the Minnesota Supreme Court has said that the might language in the second prong of Larison means that we examine whether a jury would not likely have found defendant guilty. And so the fact that the district court worded that slightly different than the direct Larison language, it doesn't matter. It's a difference without any distinction.
Is it really a difference without a distinction? Isn't that the post-conviction court misinterpreting and then misapplying the second prong of the Larison test?
I don't believe so, under the standard laid out by the Minnesota Supreme Court.
So it seems like the focus of the test, if we just look at Larison itself, is whether the trial testimony was false, but for that testimony, what would the jury at trial have done?
Right.
And you disregard the recantation. Right? You just kind of excise from the trial transcript the false parts or that entire testimony and then ask would the verdict have been different. That seems to be a very different standard than asking what the district court did here, which is if in this alternative universe, instead of this trial testimony, the recantation had been the trial testimony, the verdict would have been the same. Those seem to be two different standards, not a distinction without a difference, but actually two different standards, right?
To a point, I think so. I think that'd be a fair characterization, but I think what matters in this case is that we don't even need to get to the second prong of Larison. And so the way that the district court ruled on that first prong of Larison, that's what matters here, and that's what this court needs or should affirm on.
Okay, it looks like there are no other questions. So.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
The respondent says that when kidnapping begins doesn't matter, but it has to matter. There has to be a point in time where testimony or evidence is supplied to a jury where they can say this person
actually was in a response to Judge Reyes's question, and the basis of that was if kidnapping is ongoing and the person's not free to leave, does it matter whether they got in the car of their own free will or not? If once they're in the car, they're prohibited from leaving.
Well, as you were discussing with the respondent, the jury, you take out the false testimony, and the jury's left with whatever they heard during trial. The jury didn't hear much about what happened in the car at trial other than the assault.
Is the assault enough to infer she wasn't free to leave? I mean, the facts surrounding it are you know, I don't want to say, if they're evocative, let's say.
I agree, but I don't think that inference can be made in this second prong. I mean, in other cases where they, where the court didn't find that either both prong one and two of the Larison test were met, there was substantial other evidence. There were other witnesses. There was corroborating evidence that went against the recantation. But in this particular case, the state didn't have to say that BT was kidnapped at some point in the car, because they had BT testify that she was minding her own business in the bar. She finds out the appellate had been there. She walks out. He surprises her. He jumps out of the car, yells at her, grabs her, puts her in. That's a very different, that fact scenario right there. I mean, if the jury believed BT, I mean, they met at least the first element of the kidnapping statute. And then there's a second element, for the purpose of. And there were two different for the purpose of charges here. One was to commit an assault, a felony assault. The other was to terrorize. Ultimately, the jury acquitted on the terrorizing kidnapping and found guilty on the assault. Interesting enough, they did not, when they were going through Blakely, they did not find that the assault took place in BT's zone of privacy, which means they did not find that a felony assault took place at the home. So they didn't have to decide this. The state didn't have to argue if there was a kidnapping in the car, if there was a kidnapping at home. And both the court and the respondents are relying on this moment in time that the appellate is arguing is false, completely false testimony, to then say it's okay, the jury would have come to this conclusion anyways. But they didn't have to think about it. And if they didn't have to think about it, I don't know how you can't say if they didn't hear the testimony that was basically the first element of the case, of the charge, that the verdict might not have been different. Because we don't know what the state would have presented. We're left with what the record was, but there isn't a record of her saying, I tried to get out of the car. I told him to let me out of the car. The record is, he beat me up in the car. He stopped. She didn't ask for help. She didn't try to get out. Then she asked him to take her home, and he did.
But the jury, the fact finder, can make reasonable inferences based on the facts. Why isn't a reasonable inference that when somebody is beating you and hitting you and assaulting you over and over and over in a truck, that you're not free to leave? That seems like a pretty reasonable inference that a jury could find, even putting aside all the testimony of how she got into the car. Who cares how she got into the truck?
Well, one could argue that.
Is it important what happened while she was in the truck?
It is, but one could argue anybody in a car is not free to leave. If it's driving on the road, I mean,
that's a different fact scenario than what we have here, where somebody is assaulted and over and over and over. And we have to defer to the facts that were found and reasonable inferences from those facts.
Well, that would be up to the jury to try to infer. I think this, whether or not she. My time is up. Can I finish answering the question? Whether or not she testified to not wanting to be in the car, whether or not the but for the purpose of elements were established, because they have to also consider why was the appellate doing what he was doing. And that needs to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you both for the oral arguments and the briefing. It was well done. We appreciate that. Also want to just highlight Ms. Johnson. Thank you very much for your arguments. I think you have a bright future in appellate advocacy if you continue to want to pursue that path. So thank you. Thank you, Mr.